Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is me, Fran Lewis, your host, and I am so excited. The rain finally stopped, but it threatens to start again tomorrow, so we have to pray that it doesn't start up during this great interview. And I have a New York Times bestselling author here of this book, The Keeper, and of course my favorite character, Wyatt Hunt. I hope he brings him back in the next one because he's really hot and he's great. And if you haven't read Silent Hunt in Face Off, the new murder mystery Face Off, where two characters face off in the story, you need to get it because it's really, really good. So, hi, John. This is John Lesquire, and I am so excited. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Oh, better. The drilling stopped.
The drilling has stopped. That's good.
Yeah, we hope that they don't continue. They promised they were going to stop, you know, renovating for at least an hour.
Perfect.
So, The Keeper is an interesting title that has a lot of different meanings. What is this? Give everybody like a short summary of this plot. We don't want to give away anything.
This is a book that kind of began 2 years ago when I read the book Gone Girl. And this is the first time it's ever happened to me that I've read a book and I went, you know, I love that book. It's really good. Mm-hmm. But the idea is so universal and so cool about, you know, a missing woman that I just said, I'm going to write another one. I'm going to write another book with a different, completely different story, but I'm just going to have that be the center of the story, where a guy goes away at the beginning. In this case, he's going down to the airport to pick up his stepbrother for Thanksgiving. And when he comes home, he had left his wife doing the dishes and the kids were asleep. When he comes home, his wife is gone. And, you know, it's like, really? What happened? Where is she? And, you know, that's just, it's just a great kickstart, you know, way to get a book moving. And so I decided to go that direction. I think it worked out pretty well.
It did work out pretty well because, like I said, there were three authors, you, Steve Berry, and Daniel Palmer, and John Land, who give me eye strain every time I get a book because I start it and I have to finish it, like right away.
That's music to my ears.
Right. Yes, with the truth, because it doesn't happen too often that I get a lot of books, and I have like 50 inside, and if it takes me more than 2 days to read 400 pages, you're in trouble, big trouble. But this took me like, you know, I took my time. I took 2 hours. Usually it takes less because
me. This is what you should know from an author's point of view is, you know, I spend a year writing these things, and then people read them in 2 hours or 5 hours or whatever it is, and it just seems unfair. You know, I want to take everybody and slow them down on purpose and go, really? You can't read it that fast. It's not right. I spent too many hours writing it.
Well, usually what happens is with your books, I read the book, then I put it down, then I write the review, then I go back to the book because I've already scribbled in it.
Sure.
That's the one my brother-in-law took and won't give back. And then I go into the review to make sure that I didn't mess up or that I didn't write something wrong, then I reread it before the interview to make sure I have it right.
Perfect. Great.
Otherwise, you've got to, you know, work on a book for hours, otherwise forget it.
Well, here's a great moment. When I finished this book, I gave it to my son, Jack, who is a voracious reader. And I just brought home the manuscript of it, put it on the counter, and said, well, if you ever want to take a look at this book, you know, you can. Well, I woke up the next morning at 6 o'clock and he had a post-it on the front of the book that said, awesome book, Dad. And I just went, that's not possible. You couldn't have read this whole book in that time. But he did.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, you can't. That's what happens when you start one of your books. It's
addicting. Well, it's good to hear.
And the plot was so diverse. And of course you brought back Abe, and I love Abe.
I love Abe too.
But the
problem with bringing back Abe is I know whenever I bring Abe back, I'm going to put him in some kind of jeopardy and make him have to go through some kind of human development that is just awful because, it always is Abe, and he's the one who takes the brunt of all of this stuff. And I think in this book, he just decided that he was going to, you know, step up and come to the fore. When I first started writing it, it was all about Dismas, and then all of a sudden Abe showed up, and Abe took off and ran with it.
Yeah, he does. So how come you made him become a private investigator?
Well, you know, in my last book, The Ophelia Cut, I know you did. We talked about it. In that book, Abe got fired from his job. I mean, once again, another something that goes wrong with Abe. and mm-hmm. kind of really not because of anything he did, but just because of politics and how crazy the world is. And so after 40 years as a cop, he got laid off. And so in this book, I wanted to bring him back, and I didn't exactly know how to do it. And so I had to have my friend Wyatt Hunt, who you think is so hot.
I think he's great.
he had to get out of Dodge, and he's in Australia on his honeymoon. So you know that Wyatt got married to the woman that he was, you know, Tamara, who he was in love with 2 books ago. And so now Abe was the natural person for Hardy to go to if he needed a private investigator.
Now, there are going to be an awful lot of girls out there that are going to be really upset when they find out that he's married. Not
well, you know,
that,
he may come back as a, you know, something may happen to her. I could be like Dave Robichaux, you know, James Lee Burke's character, and kill, you know, 4 or 5 of his wives.
Either that or she can, you know, cheat on him, or you can just, you know, he can come back and realize it's not for him to be married, the poor thing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. You know, nah, violence is good. You never know.
Thanks for the tip. Exactly. Right.
So who is Dismiss? How did Dismiss get involved in this, and why did Hal Chase need to hire him?
Well, this came about really in a good way. I was thinking about the fact that I had not really used Dismiss's wife, Franny, as a main character in many books. It had been a long time since I'd really paid attention to her.
Mm,
and
yeah.
During that time, she became a marriage and family counselor, which I refer to in several of the books, but I never really showed her going to work or talked about her clients or anything like that. So in this book, it made perfect sense that the missing woman would have gone to a therapist. She would have gone to talk about her crumbling marriage and her difficult children and all of these things. And so Franny was a natural choice for her to go to. And then in the course of talking about who she was seeing, she probably mentioned Dismiss's name to her husband. So there's the connection between her husband and Diz. And finally, when he is visited by the homicide police, when Katie is just missing, there's no indication she's been dead.
Yeah.
But the homicide police come and see Hal after 4 days, and they go, you know, we're going to find out about your alibi and really talk about that. And he gets the, you know, very clear impression that they think he's a suspect in a murder that they don't even know is a murder yet.
Mm. I know. But when Franny comes in, she sees Katie.
Right.
And Katie has a serious problem.
Katie's got more than one serious problem.
See, yes. I know. We don't want to give away too many of her problems.
No. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Hal works in a jail, right? So he's got problems there, too, that we could
talk
about.
Well, he works in the San Francisco County Jail. And in real life, the San Francisco County Jail really is not a really great place. It has a lot of problems. It has a lot of – this is in real life, not in fiction. And it's one of the reasons I decided to write about the jail, because there are, you know, tremendous problems there, both in terms of the inmates and the guards and the sheriff. And it's fascinating to write about those kind of situations that are really going on in real life and bring them into a story.
Yeah, that was interesting. And Bert Cushing is the person that he works for, right?
Bert Cushing is he's the sheriff. And what's so interesting about the sheriff in San Francisco is that the sheriff is a county position. And so it is a totally separate jurisdiction than the police or the DA or any of that stuff. So the sheriff really kind of is a, you know, a man in his own, on his own, and he can do anything he wants to do. Nobody really watches out for what he does. And suddenly when there, you know, begins to be some problems at the jail and inmates wind up being dead, nobody really, you know, looks too hard at the reasons these people die, because it all seems to be rational and reasonable. Somebody had an overdose and, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe they just come in off the street and they had some pure heroin and they die in the jail. But, you know, after this happens 5 or 6 times over the course of this book, you start to get the impression that something is going on there. It's really, really pretty bad. And is related to Hal, because Hal is a guard there.
So they assume that he would be part of this.
Yeah,
so this guy, Bert Cushing, has a hold over all of these guards, though. They're afraid of him.
The guards are afraid of him, and the inmates are afraid of the guards. And it's very much a dysfunctional, very difficult, dangerous place to work.
That's horrible. And to know that it's true, Mm-hmm. That's even scarier. I'm going to be interviewing in 2 weeks a lady that actually gave up working in a private school to work with young kids that are inmates.
Mm-hmm.
She's really amazing because it's called Tales from a Jailhouse Librarian, and she turned them on to books, which I sent 10 to the prison.
Oh, that's a terrific
kids.
Idea.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'm so excited that, you know, that she's doing this. But it's sad because even the kids are given the wrong information. And when they want to go for an education, they're not always, you know, the people that work there, you know, they'll send them to another place just before the GED is supposed to come out and they're supposed to get the test. And they lose.
Right.
It's sad. So she's doing so much for them. So as an educator myself, I couldn't hesitate but then to send them 10 copies of the books I wrote.
That's great. Teams. That's great.
So Dimas asks Abe Glitzy to take over the investigation to see what, you know, to see what's happening with Hal's wife.
Well, it's
and,
really kind of interesting that there's not really an investigation because there's not really a body. And
they didn't find anybody.
Right. And so what they need to do is have Abe, what Hardy needs to have Abe do is kind of prepare for an onslaught against Hal. Because for some reason, Hardy just believes Hal. He says, you know, I don't think this guy did it. He came to me, you know, early on. He just needed help to get through so he didn't get, you know, say something wrong to the cops. And then suddenly here he is looking like he's going to be a suspect in a murder that doesn't really exist. So Hardy goes to Glitzky and says, you know, this is exactly the opposite of all the other jobs you've ever done. I want you to figure out a way that you can prove this guy not guilty. And so Glitzky goes really on a different path than he's ever been down before. And it's really fascinating to watch what he does, I think.
I think he's great. I mean, you want him to investigate because he doesn't let up.
Mm-hmm.
He won't back off either.
No,
and
he doesn't have that genetic.
Happy.
Yeah, he doesn't have any genetic component to back off. And, you know, one of the things I loved about this is when you start out from really a blank slate in an investigation, I mean, you have to consider all the possibilities. And another possibility that I really found very compelling was, what if this woman killed herself? I mean, obviously she's very upset. She's been seeing a counselor. You know, Thanksgiving is a very emotional time of year. Her kids are kind of a mess. You know, it's very reasonable to think that she would have killed herself. And Abe, you know, goes down that road quite a long ways until he discovers, you know, that she's gotten rid of her own body in a very effective way.
We're not going to tell anybody what happened.
No, we're not telling anybody anything.
No. So who are the members of Katie's family, and what are their takes on Hal?
Well, this is what made this book so interesting and fun to write, is the families... You know, really, the families are all over the place. You know, Katie has one brother who's absolutely convinced that Hal did it. She's got two sisters that are kind of on the fence. The father thinks Hal did it. It's interesting. The men kind of all line up, you know, to think that the husband did it, whereas all the women are a little bit less, you know, forward about thinking that that's really what is going to be happening and what has happened. So they give kind of different messages to Glitzky, and he's left to sort them all out, which is part of what makes it kind of fun and workable.
Yeah, but Hal's not innocent either because he's having fun with somebody else.
Well, having is a good word. He has had a relationship with another woman. And, you know, this is just such a classic among – one of the things I wanted to deal with in this story was the whole – difficulty of raising small children. And I've been through it, and I think most of my readers have been through it. And it's just such an incredibly emotional and can be such a, you know, absolutely mind-altering and life-altering experience to have young children. And some people just don't make it through that. In fact, a lot of people don't. And so I really wanted to kind of explore that whole feeling of the despair that creeps into a marriage when one person wants to kind of try to live a normal life and the other person becomes more and more obsessed with trying to be a better mother and, have nothing go wrong with their children, and they become completely, to use a word that has keeper in it, they become gatekeepers. So they don't let the husband help. They don't let the husband change the diapers. They don't let the husband put the kids to bed. And the husband becomes more and more estranged, and sometimes he turns to other people to make him feel worthwhile.
Well, he did. He turned to Patty, but then you begin to wonder about her, too. You created suspicion in everyone.
Well, you know, that's kind of the ball game in writing mysteries. You know,
he
you
did.
Want to have a lot of plausible suspects. You want
mm-hmm.
to have some really good motives. And, you know, Patty, I just love to write about her because I really love writing about people who, you know, the weird things have happened to. And
mm-hmm.
in Patty's case, this happened to me. I was talking to some woman who was a typist, maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. And this was during the dot-com bubble, and she was a typist for a company I'd never heard of. And she, the company went mm-hmm. public, and she had been, like, with them right from the beginning, and she made $11 million.
Oh, God.
And I went, you got to be kidding. I mean, at the time, I'm a struggling young writer, and I'm going, are you kidding me? I said, you type for a year or two for these people? Because believe me, I've typed for everybody on the planet, you know. And so I go, you've typed for like 2 years for these people and you made $11 million? And she goes, yeah, isn't that cool? I went, yeah, isn't it cool? Wow.
It's not, oh, God, don't you love a
So this is what happened to Patty. She was, you know, she's a person
yeah.
who just got into the right place and happened to be there and was just an administrator doing not much. And suddenly she made $5 or $6 million. And, you know, that's a little bit of a motive for Hal to want to be with her because she is not only beautiful, but she's rich.
So beautiful that a lot of the cops got tongue-tied when she walked through the door. I'm not mistaken.
I love doing that.
You did
you know,
a good job on that.
You know, when you write these books, it's very important, I think, to keep the fun factor pretty high up in the books because you're writing about serious, you know, very serious issues. And to have it be all about that issue wouldn't be entertaining. And, you know, I think the basic job is to entertain while you're trying to get some kind of more, you know, difficult message across.
Well, Katie was rich, too. She was a pharmaceutical rep, right?
Well, she was a pharmaceutical rep until she stopped working to be a full-time mother.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is the exact kind of thing that happens quite frequently. I mean, especially among professional women when they have to make that very difficult choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you want to go back to work or do you want to be home with your kid? And I know in the case of my wife, who is an architect, you know, when we had our second child, it was like, you know what, I really don't want to be working anymore. And I'm going, well, okay. So I started, you know, I was working 3 jobs at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And it all worked out, but it was a challenging time. And it was most of it was very difficult for my wife's kind of feeling of self-esteem because she felt like she was a professional woman and people did not value motherhood as a profession as much as they did architecture.
Yeah, I can understand. You know, it's funny because I retired from teaching. I was a reading and writing staff developer and a dean.
Mm-hmm.
And someone called me yesterday, and I said, I'm very busy. I have a lot of reviews. I'm doing my magazine. And they go, oh, what could you have to do that you're so busy? You retired. And I got really annoyed. I go, I guess, you know, writing 11 books and working on a magazine and interviewing authors on my radio
right.
show and
right.
putting together, you know, the reviews for them and making sure that I get them done in a timely fashion and doing some articles for, you know, other people. I guess you're right. I'm not busy. I just must have all the time
well,
in the world
know,
to do lunch
yeah.
like you do.
Yeah, just sit around and eat bonbons all day, right?
That's what she does. This person
right.
does. She does lunch and she does bridge and mahjong.
Sure.
And I think I would take yay. I said
yeah.
that's not me. I said I love reading. I said and there are times I just want to take a walk and get away from you know my review because I want to make sure that it's exactly what the author would want me to you know to get from the person from reading the book. And
exactly.
she said, oh well. She said, well, why do you do it? I said, not because they pay me, because they don't. And she said. I said, well, why do you do it at all? I said, maybe it's because after 36 years of teaching in the public school system in New York City, and I loved every minute of it, now I do what
mm-hmm.
I want.
Yeah.
I said, I could sit at home and get fat. I did for a while, and I'm very thin. I said,
mm-hmm.
or I can, you know, use my mind to help other people. So, yeah,
exactly.
they think that. And motherhood is difficult, and you know what? Whoever
well,
doesn't value
yeah.
it, it's too, they're
right.
really... It's wrong. It's a full-time profession, but in a different way.
Exactly. And it's anyway, this is, I think this is something that so many, you know,
yeah,
people have dealt with and are dealing with. I mean, the whole question about where you fit in the world and who's taking care of the, yeah, children and who's taking care of the business and all this stuff. You know, it was very, it's the one part of the book that I felt like it was difficult to write, because it was difficult to make this sound like it was, I like to write about people who are kind of really sympathetic, and you're rooting for them both. And I think in this case, I had these two people who really just were having a hard time. I mean, they weren't getting along. They didn't seem to have much fun. And all of a sudden, the wife disappears. I mean, it's powerful stuff.
Yeah, she stays disappeared, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
So Abe is really persistent, but he had never really done a case like this, so he used his police background.
Right.
But the job of a private investigator is different. So who were Abby and Jay Morris? Who were the detectives that worked along with the DA?
Well, you know, you always want to have a legitimate police presence in these books.
Yeah.
I mean, because there are, you know, rules of procedure and how they're supposed to go about looking for things and what they're supposed to look at and how they handle it. And these two guys I needed to have as a kind of a ticking clock that just showed the way, mm-hmm, everything, you know, inexorably moved ahead, especially once they get their minds wrapped around one particular person as a suspect. Then you have this whole, you know, groundswelling of procedure that kind of keeps moving in the same direction. It's like a mountain. You can't change its direction very much. And I really wanted to show that they, even though there wasn't really any growing evidence against Hal, as time went by, it became more and more clear that Abby and Jamoris both thought that he was more and more guilty as time went by. And so the clock was ticking on his, you know, on how long it would be before he got sent to jail, even without a body. And that's the thing that was really fun. I mean, because, you know, you don't really need a body. Everybody says you need a body. And, you know, one of the things I found out researching the book is that corpus delicti does not mean the missing body. It means body of evidence. And it's a very, you know, maybe a small legal point, but it's pretty powerful. And so they wound up arresting Hal.
And the grand jury went, but Abe stuck by him, even though he could have been in danger, and you do endanger the poor guy.
Yeah,
But there's one character.
Well, the great thing that happens to Abe in this book is that Abe becomes obsessed.
Yes.
You know, and this is so different from what he's ever done before.
OCD all the way.
I mean, really, he just becomes obsessed, and he realizes that this is an injustice somehow. He doesn't know how. But it falls, you know, finally he realizes that Abby and Jamoris and Devin Jewell and everybody else involved in the case has got to be wrong. He doesn't know how they're wrong, but he knows they've got to be wrong. And he just becomes this kind of, goes into overdrive, and I think that's what drives the final third of the book, is just watching Abe going crazy. It's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, I thought maybe he was going to have a stroke or a heart attack or worse. His wife was going to, you know, chain him to the house and not let him leave. My God.
Exactly.
He was so upset that he just lost sight of everything.
He did. And, you know, that's such it's so different from a guy who's used to dealing with civil procedure and used to dealing with playing by the rules. And I think it shocked him as much as it, you know, shocks us to read about him. But he's really in a very, very difficult place, you know, before this book comes to an end, let me say.
Yeah, he was, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So first of all, if anybody needs a detective or somebody on the case, you want to call the guy from the book, seriously, because he's really good. But they thought he was way off base. They didn't think that he was right.
Right.
And his wife didn't really want him to come out of retirement, so it sort of put a strain on their relationship, right?
Sure, right. I mean, everything he did, it put a strain on something, you know, because this is not who he is. And all of a sudden, he's a fish out of water trying to do this very difficult thing and trying to find, you know, evidence where maybe no evidence even exists. And it's just, it's great. It's just really great.
Now, I'm looking at chapter 46. It's in front of me. There's an interesting article that you put in there. District Attorney Wes Farrell has wasted no time filing the vacancy in his investigation division.
Yeah.
Okay, with Maria Solis Martinez. That was really what you did with that. Wow. So you filled that, and then...
Well, Maria is a another person who, you know, when the book began, she was not even a glimmer in her author's eye.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I said, well, you know what? I'm going to need somebody to address the issues that are going on in the jail and somehow bring it around so that it includes both what Glitzky's looking at and what Hal is, you know, trying to get away from. And so she comes to the conclusion that she determines that there are issues in the jail. She's an assistant district attorney. And she goes to the jail. She goes to someone who has recanted his testimony about something that he saw. And she tries to convince this guy that he is, he can be protected. Everything's going to work out fine, you know, if he just gives his testimony. And, you know, it's one of the tragedies in the middle of this book. I mean, that things go horribly awry. And, you know, with no sign that this was going to happen, it was just things don't work out.
For a lot of people.
You're allowed to say that, aren't you? You can say things don't work out.
Don't work out. Yeah, you're allowed to say that, but I'm not going to say how they don't work out because I never give away. The one thing about me is that I don't give away spoilers because, you know, it's very rare that I'll come up with a spoiler even in my review. And what I might not think of as a spoiler, the author might say, could you take that sentence out? And then go like, I could if I wanted to, if you're real nice to me. If I agree, I usually take it out. The only time I won't is if they say, oh, well, you know, your review was really great. Could you make it shorter? No, I can't. Sorry. No. I worked on it for 7 hours. No, I can't
people,
do that.
People, when you're writing a long, great review, I don't think people want you to cut it shorter, you know.
No, and I never give away anything, and I usually provide, like, you know, thought questions at the end. And
exactly.
I've never had, you know, the authors don't complain, so I just, like, I don't really, you know, don't sit and worry about it.
Yeah.
So Bert Cushing is a really nasty man. I don't like him.
No,
but,
Bert Cushing is... You know, he's based on a real guy in San Francisco.
Oh, God.
he is the last sheriff of San Francisco that got elected. Basically, the first thing he did after he got elected was he beat his wife. And this is true. And the mayor, who does not have jurisdiction over him, though, would not let him take his office, would not let him go to the office. So, I mean, this has been going on. There's been lawsuits going on for about 18 months in San Francisco all about this kind of thing. And I decided, I mean, it's not like the real DA in San Francisco, but I decided to make a fictional character who was really, you know, really on top of his game as a politician. And he had allies among the mayor and among the other players in the town, the supervisors. And really, in his heart, he is just a very, very, very evil man.
Yeah, and the chief of police was... Well, he was an interesting character, too.
Yeah. Good.
So
let me ask you a question.
Uh-oh.
Okay. One of the things I've tried to do in this book, and I really had a lot of fun with, is when I got into Dismas Hardy and his personality a little bit more than I have in the past, where he becomes this dart. He's playing darts one day, and this is one of my favorite... One of my favorite scenes in the book, he's shooting a game called 20 Down. And, you know, in my past books, he's playing darts, and always somebody comes in and interrupts him. And it's kind of a long-standing joke that I've had running with my readers. And in this book, he all of a sudden, he goes all the way down, hits the bullseye to win it, never makes a miss. And I just thought it was one of the most fun scenes I'd ever written in my whole life.
I thought it was really cool because, in a sense, it's his personality because he's always right on target with what he wants to do.
Yeah, right.
So
it's a very good analogy. I mean, I just thought it was so much fun to write. And then when he first – that's how he first comes back to meet Glitzky. He invites Glitzky down to celebrate that he has, you know, won this – you know, had this game with himself that he won. And then all of a sudden Glitzky's there. And Glitzky is just – at the beginning of this book, he's just a bumbling sad sack. You know, he's watching – reruns of Friends on television. He's, you know, he's reading books about Japanese netsukis, you know, which is little porcelain figures. I mean, he's just completely not the person we used to know. And I think that's one of the reasons that really Hardy gets drawn to bring him into the case, to kind of, like, you know, buck him up and cheer him up. And little does he know, it's probably not going to be the best thing he could choose for him to do.
He creates a whole other Abe Gutsky. It's almost as if he's got a multiple personality.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it is. It's scary. And I hope that you bring him back in the next one so that he could do some more damage.
Well, he's
going to
definitely.
You.
He's already back in the What's
what?
That?
You can't
he's already back in the next one. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But you can't kill him off. Not yet, anyway. No, you can't.
No. I can't kill Abe. People would kill me if I killed Abe.
And you can't kill Dismiss, and you can't
no.
kill him. And Wyatt. Anybody else, you have to ask me first. I'll let you know.
Okay, yeah.
I mean,
but you know
I
what? You got to kill people from time to time to keep your credibility.
Oh, you did it. You did in the Ophelia cut. It's like,
yeah, let's not
oh
say who.
Oh, my God.
I know. I feel really bad about it still.
Yeah,
you know, I just got back from being on my, you know, my book tour, and I have to tell you, I had so many people come up to me on this tour and go, really? You had to do that? I went, yeah, I kind of did have to do it.
That ending in the courtroom was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then of course, you killed off this other one in
yeah.
Hunter. And I go, like, wait a minute, I didn't even get to know this cool guy. and he's gone. You can't.
It's
why
so
Hunter?
Fun.
Yeah. I know, it's not right. Now, Franny
right.
Hardy saw Katie as a therapist.
Yeah.
So how come?
Well, because Katie, as I've been saying here, you know, really changed a lot over the last 3 or 4 years since she had children. She was before, she was this high-powered, you know, sexy professional woman who, mm-hmm. you know, made a lot of money and was, you know, really on top of her game and her career. And, you know, she was in a different position vis-a-vis Hal, who was kind of a blue-collar guy, worked as a jail guard. You know, that's not really a big, you know, a big-time job.
Mm.
And then suddenly she kind of let this whole question about being a full-time mother kind of take over her identity, and she wouldn't let Hal help her. And then suddenly she said to Hal, you know, basically, you've got to now make all the money. And so they were in incredible trouble about money. There just wasn't enough to go around. And so she, you know, wanted to keep this together because her vision of herself was this mm-hmm. strong, professional, great, solid woman. But actually her life was falling apart around her, and so she came to Franny and wanted to talk about that stuff. But it was, you know, it led to some very interesting complications in terms of in terms of Abe and Diz. Because, you know, everything Katie told Franny was privileged.
Yeah, she couldn't.
So Franny,
yeah,
Franny knows all this stuff about Katie, but she can't really tell anybody. And it's a very interesting dynamic, I think, in the story, to how this stuff kind of gets leaked out piecemeal. And, you know, Abe kind of teases it out of Franny and does it without really, you know, jeopardizing the privilege conversations, but finally gets a sense of what they're doing and what's going on in the real world.
Well, she's a good therapist. It was an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
It was an interesting conversation. I mean, for anybody that she's a therapist, whatever, and it was very non-threatening, so she felt comfortable talking to her.
Right. Well,
then,
I mean, you know, then Franny, who one of the great things is this is the first time I've been able to show Franny really at work. And I love to find out where people live and how they work and what mm-hmm. her office is like. And it's just such an interesting, you know, kind of exploration of a new character who's been in the series for a long while. But then to see her kind of step up and become a, you know, a player in the actual plot is pretty fascinating, I think.
Yeah, it was. Now, you talked about the jail there.
Uh-huh.
And the inmates in this real jail and in this particular jail, there's no protection or safeguards to prevent them from getting hurt.
No.
So how do they?
And this
I
is
mean,
true everywhere because these are people that no one cares about.
That's scary.
By and large, once you're in the system, you know, if you are kind of a low-ranking criminal, and you are low-ranking because the jail is not a prison. You know, it's a jail. It's very different. But there's just a million people. I mean, the crowding of the jails in California is a national scandal. And so these cells that are meant to hold one or two people now hold five people.
Wow.
And there's just, you know, it's just there's a whole kind of a feeling like this is a zoo. And that's another one of the possible meanings for keeper, because the sheriff is called the zookeeper because these people are like animals in a zoo. They're being kept in cages. You know, they have no rights. They can't really do anything. And by the way, it also turns out there's probably some very illegal, contraband being sold in these jails. That's obviously coming in through the guards and coming in through the, you know, through the outside population.
Well, after reading the tales of a prison from a jailhouse librarian, mm-hmm. and the journey of a prison family written by a prisoner in a Texas prison, and this other lady, I learned that it's not Mayberry RFD. And Andy Griffin is not the sheriff, and these people are not given the basics, even the basics of hygiene, even soap and toothpaste. They're given like little powdered stuff.
When I know it's pretty amazing.
Thing, it's horrible. I mean, I realize that they committed a crime, but in order to get them to be rehabilitated, which they don't care because they would rather have them there because it's more money, and have them not come back, because they, from what I've read, they don't really care about that either. They would much rather have repeaters. They would rather mistreat them and create the violence. So even in this jail, the guards would look away. If somebody was getting hurt, they wouldn't stop them, would they?
That's right. No. I mean, it's all about just making sure that, you know, the business of the jail, I mean, the illicit business of the jail, continues, because there's money to be made. And these guards don't have a lot of money, and there's a lot of motivation to, you know, let's say a disincentive to be paragons of virtue. And I'm not saying that all the guards are this way at all. I mean, obviously, in real life, most of the guards, it's the toughest job in the whole world. And, you know, you're not allowed to have really any weapons in there, because you can't put yourself in a situation where the prisoners can get to those weapons. So this is very much a, you know, hand-to-hand kind of a situation in the jail, where it's just a matter of authority and then punishment. And it's just a very challenging place, let me say.
It's like these guards, I mean, they have to do something. I mean, if there's a prison riot or whatever, and you hear about them all the time.
Yeah.
They don't have any kind of weapons,
no.
Billy club, they're just their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And yet some of the inmates will take like a plastic fork and turn it into a weapon.
Well, yeah. The whole jail situation is really a very, very serious, you know, thing. And it really is something that people, I have found, don't normally want to think about. You have to kind of bring people around to any kind of discussion about this, kind of in the back door way, because it's such a kind of a lower, I don't mean to say lower, it's kind of a part of society that we just tend to want to ignore. Once these people are moved out of society and put into a jail, they are not really citizens anymore. And it's a whole different feel.
Well, when I read this other book, it said that in a sense, that the purpose of the prison or the jail is to keep them out of society, so they no longer have to be worried about them hurting people on the outside. So
that's
who
right.
cares about what happens to them on the inside?
Who cares about what happens on the – yeah.
And then, but there are people that are in jail that don't belong there too, that have been wrongly accused. I mean, you hear it on the news all the time. The guy that was in jail for 19 years for killing someone, and he didn't do it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the scary part, that I could see where somebody in one of your books or anybody's book, you know, the police have the wrong suspect, and they just get the wrong guy because they don't want to look any further than the person that
they
think they did it.
Well, this is the thing that's kind of like a, you know, a common theme that I think has run through a lot of my books, is the fact that this whole idea of you know, the police presence kind of moves ahead in its own inexorable pace, and they narrow their list of suspects down, and they get to one, and then pretty soon that one person, I mean, you know, he could go to the mailbox, and they could take, you know, and say, you know, that's a suspicious activity. Because, you know, once you're primed to look at something and see only one thing, that tends to be what you see. So
yeah, they have It's like a veiled. It's like a veiled look. Like they have a, you know, like a black veil over them, and then that's what I don't want. I'm not going to lift it because you're guilty. The mayor wants them in jail, so it makes it look right that we have somebody and we arrested them. That's great.
Right. Right.
And then, that's scary. That is so scary.
Well,
so,
we have covered. I think we've covered the whole jail side of things, you know, pretty well. You know, the other side of the story in this book really is Hal's family. You know, he's got a stepbrother and he's got a stepmother and he's got, people who are on that side of his family somewhat confused and difficult.
Well, the children, the two children, his son and his daughter, and then there's Ruth, the stepmother.
Right.
So she's an interesting person.
She is, she is someone who you just, you know, she's kind of a hovering presence, I think, throughout the whole book. And
yeah,
it's
I don't
because
like her.
I don't think you're going to like her, but she's,
like her.
You know, she's working with Katie and trying to protect Hal's children. And I think once again, we run into that, you know, I mean, this is a very family oriented book. I mean, everything in it is about the relationships within, you know, within families. And I think one of the things that, you know, plays very well is that Ruth really doesn't like Katie. She's really holding, you know, a big grudge against Katie's gatekeeping, where Katie just doesn't want anybody to help with the kids. And, you know, to have a grandmother who is not being able to help with her grandchildren, I think it's a pretty powerful thing. You know, you think that these things go away as you get older and you kind of mellow and you say, oh, well, that's the way those kids are. But I think in this case we're finding that not only did Ruth, you know, not like the way things were with the kids, but even Warren, you know, Hal's stepbrother, you know, he found himself in a position where he's got to defend one person or another, and he's stuck in a hard place as well.
Yeah, he defended his mother, he defended Ruth, but
but
even when she's with the children, I mean, Katie was very controlling.
Yeah.
And she wanted everything, but so Ruth was the same way.
Yeah, but she was the same way, but in a very different way. She didn't want the kids to be, in fact, this is one of the things I found fascinating, is they wanted the same kind of thing. They both wanted to be in control of the kids, but they both wanted to control them as well. They wanted, Katie wanted the kids to be perfect and, you know, well-dressed and all of these other things, whereas Ruth wanted the kids to be quiet, subservient, you know, exactly the opposite of what, you know, Katie would allow them to be. Katie wanted them to be clever and funny and smart and well-dressed, and Ruth just basically wanted them, and I think it's generational, she wanted them to be kind of out of the way and quiet, which, of course, they were not, which bothered Ruth a lot, which, of course, leads to other things.
Yeah, well, they didn't like exactly being with her either.
Yeah,
but my mother,
right.
My mother was a Ruth. She wasn't like that. No,
no. No. Well, my mother was a doll. You know,
yeah,
my mother was great too.
I can't imagine this lady throwing a ball or playing with dolls or dancing or smiling. She reminded me of worse than a stepmother in Snow White, who was one of my favorite characters, Maleficent. I mean, seriously, and the stepmother in Cinderella was nothing compared to this lady. She's more like a stepford wife gone mad. So,
she was definitely, very, I think, between her and Hal. And, you know, I mean, the family... You know, the family dynamic here that's going on throughout this book is just like it's a tightly wound spring. And, you know, when it starts to come undone, it has some pretty strong, you know, after effects.
That's true. It's like a reverberating echo that doesn't let up.
Yeah.
What can I say? So,
well, that's fun. Do you think we should talk a little bit about Face Off for a minute?
Oh, okay, yeah, because we don't want to give away anything.
I don't want to give away everything in this story, but I think we've piqued some interest here. I think there's a lot of pretty cool things going on. Yeah.
Okay, I have Face Off in front of me. You see, I always have my books.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you that don't know what Face Off is, John's going to tell you what it is because you're going to be jealous that you don't have a copy of it.
This is really one of the neatest ideas, I think, that I've come across in all the time I've been publishing. And that is the International Thriller Writers is an organization, obviously, of thriller writers. And what we do, we've been together for 10 years, and we don't charge dues to our members. All we try to do to raise money to run the organization is we come out with a new publication every year. The first year we came out with a book called Thriller. The second, and it was an anthology of a lot of short stories. I think something like 40 of us wrote a short story for that. And then we've had things like the 100 Best Thrillers of All Times and various other, you know, anthologies. And they pay for the administrative, you know, running of the organization. Well, last year, Steve Barry and David Morrell got the idea to do this book called Face Off. And it was where a character from one author and a character from another author would meet in a story and interact with one another. So they came up to me and they asked if I would allow one of my characters to hang out with another, you know, another one of the author, you know, thriller author characters. And so we decided to do Wyatt Hunt, your favorite. And I got hooked up with my, you know, good friend and my one of the most talented writers in America, T. Jefferson Parker. And so he's got a character named Joe Trona, who was the star of a book that won the Edgar Award called Silent Joe. So I've got Wyatt Hunt and Silent Joe Trona going to Baja, California for a fishing trip, which, by the way, Jeff and I did together in real life. And so we had a lot to draw from our mutual experiences. And so we went down to Baja, and we sent our boys down to Baja, and they get involved in a very serious kind of a thriller situation that they are in big trouble with a lot of the narco-traficants down there. So it just turns out to be a fantastic story, and that the book Face Off is it's got 11 stories like this, and some of them are like Jeffrey Deaver and John Stanford are together, I think, and I think Lee Child and Joe Finder. I mean, it's really kind of some terrific talent that were doing these stories together where, like in the case of Deaver and Sanford, their story is called Rhymes with Prey, which is fantastic because, you know, Jeffrey's character is Rhymes, and Sanford's book all have Prey in the title. So it's a great project, and we've just made, I think, really a great deal of success with it. It's one of the biggest selling anthologies of all time as of right now.
It's fantastic, and guess what? I got lucky, everybody, because I have John's story with T.J. Parker and Steve Berry's story with James Rollins. And the publicist, I specifically asked, because I was real careful when I wrote this review. I reviewed your story, then I reviewed that story, and I did not tell the person. The reader has to decide which character wins. I don't tell. I would not give it up. I said, do I have to pick a winner? Because you know who I'm going to pick. And I said, I had a choice between Cotton Malone and Gary Pierce. And you know, I love Cotton Malone and I love Wyatt Hunt. And I said, oh, my God, if they put John against Cotton, I'm in big trouble here, if Wyatt against Cotton. I don't know what I would do. So I wrote the reviews, and they come out June 9th. I have to post them wherever they tell me to post them. I don't think it's Amazon. I think it's just on my review sites, all 9 of them, and all over Facebook and everything. But at the end of the review, it says you have to decide who wins. They don't I want to see what they say, because they specifically said I shouldn't pick a winner. So I got his character, but I'm going to read, if I ever get done with the ones that are staring at me, I am going to read the whole book. I was a little disappointed. Oh, wow. Douglas Preston and R.L. Stine and Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child.
I know.
Oh, my God. I got to read that.
I know you do. And you know what's really funny about that is when people say there's 22 stories and there's 11 stories and there's 23 authors.
Yeah.
And they go, wait a minute, that math doesn't quite work. You know what I mean? But you know you know who the characters are? I mean, the authors are?
Yeah.
In the R.L. Stine story, he's the author of Goosebumps.
Yep.
He's got a puppet. It's kind of a Charlie McCarthy figure, and his puppet is one of the authors.
Oh God, I've got to read it. And I know MJ Rose has Malachi. Lisa Gardner, I've never read. Linda Fierstein, I love her character.
She's great.
And she is great. I've never read Steve Martin. I think I read only one. Jeffrey Deaver, I read the October list.
This is like a roll call. this is like a roll call of the most popular thriller authors in the world, and they're all, you know, working together. I mean, it's just a fantastic project.
Yeah,
it turned
I was
out
disappointed,
to be just great.
Though, because I asked, it was Samantha that was originally in charge of it. Now there's an Amanda person that's in charge of it. And I had asked Samantha if she could get a group of authors for June 12th to face off on my radio show. And I was disappointed that she didn't get back to me. I think it's a little bit like herding cats.
You know, you have some, you have some kind of big names who are out there in the world, and they're doing a lot of stuff. So getting one or two of them is a little challenging.
I know. I was so happy to get you to be on the show. And I was, you know, like I said, Steve Berry was supposed to be on June 12th, but he's got something that he has to do. So we're going to reschedule, I hope, eventually after that. And before I ask you what's happening next, I promised that I was going to tell everybody my picks for this month, which are absolutely in front of me if I could find my glasses. Okay. The Keeper comes out this month, right?
It's out last week.
Last week. Okay,
actually, good news. It's actually a bestseller last Sunday. It was on the bestseller list.
That's even better because now I could post my review. I never post it until the book comes out.
Yeah, it came out on May the 6th.
Okay.
Came out on May the 6th, and it's my 17th New York Times bestseller. So I'm very happy and proud of it.
I don't blame you. It's really good.
Yeah.
And
then
I have on my list is Steve Berry's The Lincoln Myth. Mm-hmm. It's coming out May 27th. And, oh, boy, it's another one of those 497 pages in zap time.
The guy runs on a different time schedule than all the rest of us, I'll tell you.
Seriously, you're right.
Yeah.
And I have Face Off on my list of best books, Desperate by Daniel Palmer. I've got Alan Topol's The Argentine Triangle. That's another one that I read in 2 days, not even. And by a new author, this lady's 80 years old, a wing.
Get out of here.
Holy, Mary Gray Kay, and it's about a 37-year-old woman that is hungers for just to be seen, and she's she's not talented or anything, and she wants to write poems, and she meets this older man that finds her attractive, and what happens is really sad because she begins to write and he steals her poems. And what happens in between, And I learned what a sestina. I learned what a sestina is. I learned what kind of poem. So that was interesting. And a YA book, Curse of the Thrax by Mark Murphy. Really, really, really good. And for those of you that want to tune in next week, Sentinel's Choice, Mike Weisenthal. And I had to cancel last week because of the drilling and I couldn't hear myself think. Larry Thompson is going to follow with a second interview. I am so excited. So, okay,
cool.
What's next for my favorite characters?
Well, I'm about halfway through another Dismas Hardy book.
Oh, good.
And this one, it's pretty interesting because kind of an unexpected person shows up about 100 pages into the book, and that is Dismas's daughter, Rebecca. People who read my book know Rebecca. And, you know, she's graduated from law school now. And guess what? She's a working lawyer. She finds herself running her first murder case at the age of 27 years old. Hardy is sitting kind of as her second chair. Abe Glitzky is involved. He's now working for Wes Farrell in the DA's office. So we've got the whole cast of characters coming back again and doing just completely different stuff. It's really cool to see Hardy kind of in the guise of the wise old man. And his daughter, who is trying to, you know, learn the ropes and keep her client out of jail, and it seems like more and more that her client seems to be not what he seems to be. Wyatt Hunt is there. Everybody's here. You're going to love it.
Not only will I love it, but he's so cute. Maybe, you know, she could create a
Samara. You're gonna love this because one of the things that happens when Rebecca goes to see Wyatt, she found Wyatt distractingly handsome. You know,
I knew it.
Yeah, she finds him distractingly handsome, and she's almost glad that he's married because she doesn't have to think about it anymore.
That'd be more fun if she did know.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see. You know, I never know what's going to happen in these books beyond where I am. So anything could happen.
What's the title?
I don't even have a working title yet. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that they're, you know, publishers are very good at supplying titles if you don't have one. That's one of the things they like to do is title books.
Really? Well, they need to,
you know,
they need
I've written
to not
26
do the blurb.
Books. I think I've written 26 books now, and I've only written the title for them about 6 times.
Really?
20 other times I've handed in books with the title, and they don't keep it. They go, no, we don't like that title.
They have the right to override the author if you don't like the title?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the cover,
I mean, you know,
too?
Pardon me?
And the cover also?
Oh, the cover is completely theirs, usually.
Oh, whoa.
But the title especially is something we don't really have too much control over. I mean, I guess you could make a stink about it, but, you know, you don't want to make a stink. You want to make everybody happy.
Yeah,
so,
but you know what? If the title doesn't fit, well, this one does. The Keeper does.
This
but if
one
it doesn't
does
fit what the book is about, then it's not good. Also, you could tell them from this reviewer that they need to let me or you or somebody read the book flap before
well,
it comes out.
Thank you. Okay, we will do that the next time. So,
no, seriously.
So there's one other thing that I should tell my fans out there. And this is another anthology moment. There's another book that's out there called Ice Cold. And it's edited by Jeffrey Deaver and Raymond Benson. And it's stories of the Cold War. And my story is a story called The Last Confession. And in all modesty, I think it's the best thing I've ever done in my life.
Okay, so somebody has to send me a copy of it.
Yeah, it's called Ice Cold. And I think if you look it up under Amazon, it's been out for about a month. And it's another anthology. This one's put out by the Mystery Writers of America as opposed to the International Thriller Writers. But it's just a terrific story, a bunch of stories. And it's one of the ones that really just ripped me up when I started thinking about, you know, my own childhood and growing up in the Cold War and the kind of stuff that we lived with all the time, you know, getting under your desks and waiting for an atomic blast. You know, many of us have been through that, and it's just hard to imagine that was life in America.
Yeah, my mother used to tell me that we used to have to go under your desk or in the hall where there were no windows.
Exactly, as though that's going to help. You know, if an atom bomb blast hits,
it's not going to do it. It's not going to do it. And as an educator, I'll never forget when we got a phone call that there was a bomb in the school. One of the teachers went berserk and she threatened the principal. So she called in and said that there was a bomb in the school, and we were outside in 10-degree weather with no coat.
It
was horrible. I said, I don't know if that's as bad as crawling under the desk and hiding so you don't get blown up. And everybody, the next day, half of the teachers were absent because we were all sick. But thank God there was no bomb, but they arrested the person that did it. She was crazy.
Right. Right.
But, I mean, my mother would tell me, you know, the air raids and the blackouts and everything.
Yeah, it was all very real. You know, I mean, I remember it, and one of the things that, you know, it brought back to me was how terrifying it was from a child's point of view, you know, that you really thought, I mean, to me, Russia might as well have been next door, and they had a million bombs pointed at my head, and to, be able to explore that kind of psyche and that kind of worldview from this perspective, I found to be really one of the most interesting, stories I've ever been able to write.
Yeah, Jeffrey Deaver is interesting. I read October List,
and
I read it the right way.
That's
then
the backwards book, right?
And we know what I did. I read it. I figured it out. I shouldn't tell you. I didn't. I haven't ever interviewed him, and that was the first book I've read of his. And I figured it out. I don't know why I did, but I did. And I said, okay, I'm going to read it from the backwards book, and to make sure that my review was right, I read it the other way too. I read
it
both
really?
Ways.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I did. I read it both ways.
Right.
Because it's more interesting backwards. It was really backwards. You begin, you don't realize it, and they go, oh, my God, wait a minute. Didn't he just do this? Okay, so wait, didn't that happen before?
Right.
And then
right.
I said, okay, in order to write this review, I've got to read the book both ways.
That's so interesting. That hasn't occurred to me to read it backwards yet.
Because
reading
read
it backwards
back-
would be reading it forward. Right.
Yeah, exactly. I read it forward, and I said, you know what? Reading it forwards helped me to do the review. And I said, gee, you're really smart because you figured this one out.
Yeah.
I did figure it out.
Well, you are really smart, Fran.
But I try hard. That's what happens when your mother makes you read 10 books a week and take notes. You
That's
still
it.
Do it.
There it is.
But thank you so much, Don. And tell the publishing company not to spill the beans on the front cover.
Okay. I will do that next time around.
Face Off is great, and you're going to look for my review. I don't know if they want me to post it on Amazon because it's only your story and Steve Berry's story.
I don't know what they want to do about that. Yeah.
I don't know. They just told me, they assigned me the two stories, but probably if I know me, I'm going to probably read a whole bunch more. But, you know, knowing that there were 11 stories, I have to give them all justice, and how do
sure.
you not review each one of them?
Yeah.
So I'll just review them and put them all over my
review
site.
Yeah, and see what
they
pick and choose. Exactly.
Well, they're going to choose. They're going to choose yours and Steve's because they have no choice.
Well, good.
Thank you so much, and I can't wait to read the next one.
Okay, thank you. I can't wait to finish the next one.
Right. Thank you. Have
okay.
a nice day.
I'll see you, Fran. Bye.